Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the terrorist attack on Westminster Bridge and the grounds of Britain's Parliament House that left 4 dead and 20 injured, and speak with Nafees Ahmed, the editor-in-chief of Insurge Intelligence at medium.com, who was a weekly columnist for Middle East Eye and the author of Failing States, Collapsing Systems. He joins us from London to discuss the likely suspects and the motives behind today's attack, which appears to fit into the pattern and the overall strategy of ISIS, which is to drive a wedge between Muslims living in Europe and the rest of the populations in order to sow division and religious and racist animus. Then we will speak with a veteran CIA officer, Robert Baer, who is currently the National Security Affairs Analyst on CNN. He joins us to discuss the latest revelations from the Associated Press that Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, offered to help Vladimir Putin advance Russia's interests in a $10 million a year contract he signed with a Russian oligarch who is a close ally of Putin's. We will discuss the growing evidence that treason was committed by Trump's top campaign official and his former national security advisor in what was an electronic equivalent of a Pearl Harbor attack by the Kremlin on American democracy itself. Then finally, we'll assess the likelihood of the passage of the Ryan and Trump healthcare bill that was supposed to be voted on tomorrow. We will examine whether, if it fails to pass the House, could that be seen as the beginning of the end of the Trump administration, since the emperor, who threatened wayward Tea Party congressmen, would appear to have no clothes and no clout with his own party in his first effort to get a bill passed. Abby Gluck, a professor of law and director of the Solomon Center for Health Law and Policy at Yale Law School, joins us to discuss the stakes involved in the Republican repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act. And joining us now is Nafees Ahmed, who is a best-selling author, international security scholar, and investigative journalist. He's the editor-in-chief of Insurge Intelligence at medium.com and writes for Vice's science and technology magazine Motherboard, and is a weekly columnist for Middle East Eye. His latest book is Failing States, Collapsing Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nafees Ahmed.
Thanks, Ian.
And it looks as if the death toll now from the attacks on the Parliament and on Westminster Bridge have reached 4 people, including an armed police officer and a man believed to be the attacker. Is that the latest news? You're in London. So what are you hearing?
Well, I mean, at the moment, we still don't know who the suspect is. There's been some confusion about who it might be. We don't really know for sure which, you know, whether this was planned by a group or whether this was completely a lone wolf attack. Everything is very unclear. What I think we can see is that it's, given everything we know about this sort of attack, it's quite likely to have been inspired by some sort of extremist group. At the moment, I think it's more, I mean, that's the sense that it's more likely to have been an Islamist terrorist attack. There's no absolute confirmation of that. We might hear more information which changes that. But that's the current theory that I think most observers and certainly the British authorities, who aren't really saying anything, but that certainly seems to be the theory they privately are holding.
And what was the sequence of events, do you know? I believe that the people on the bridge were run over by the car that was driven by the man who then stabbed the police officer and killed him in an area of the Houses of Parliament. Is that the sequence?
That's right. It seems that this guy basically, he had driven his car across... he drove onto the pavement on Westminster Bridge and literally began mowing people down. There's been, I think apparently there's been reports that there's been a body or bodies recovered from the River Thames as a result of that. After mowing pedestrians down, you know, he got out of his car outside the parliamentary building and moved straight for a police officer and stabbed him. That police officer, unfortunately, has died. I think the latest reports are that four people have died. There's about 20 or so people who have been taken to hospital with various injuries. Some of them have been described as suffering from catastrophic injuries. So that's all the information we have at the moment.
Well, apparently among the 20 people who have injured, that includes three other police officers. So after he had stabbed the policeman in front of the Parliament building, that was when he was shot. But how did these other officers get wounded? Do we know?
No, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just don't know. I mean, I was traveling around London at that time. A friend of mine was actually in the parliamentary building when the incident happened, person of who I work very closely with, and he didn't witness anything, but when it happened, they obviously had to lock down the entire area. They locked down the parliamentary buildings, and he was there for many hours while the police and security forces were basically sweeping the area to ensure that there wasn't any threat remaining. And they only actually, I believe they only allowed them out just less than an hour ago. Less than an hour ago, really.
Well, there's a report that I'm just looking at now that indicates that on the bridge where he mowed down pedestrians before trying to enter the parliament, and where he stabbed the police officer and was subsequently shot, that among the people that were hit on the bridge were three police officers who were on their way back from a commendation ceremony. So that appears to be, and I understand among those 20 that were injured on the bridge was a group of French teenagers visiting London on a school.
Yeah, I've heard that
outing.
As well. Yeah. I mean, again, these reports may, I'm not sure how confirmed these reports are. That's certainly, I've heard that report as well about the French youngsters who were also basically mowed down as well. I mean, it's absolutely horrifying, really. I think what we can see from this attack is that whoever has perpetrated it, their aim is likely to have been aligned with the idea that ISIS has, which is basically to target the gray zone, and the gray zone is the arena of coexistence within the West, of different faiths, different cultures, people living together happily in peace, working together, and they have this idea, you know, so that our kind of ideology has certainly been attractive to many, it's influenced many extremist groups. So it does seem to me that within, you know, it fits within the line of recent attacks that we've had over the last few years, you know, in France, you know, in Brussels and elsewhere, where we've had this effort to say, well, we want to target these areas and we want to turn people against each other. And really my response to that would simply be, well, London is not going to do that. You know, London is not going to turn on itself. We aren't going to turn against each other.
And again, I'm speaking with Nafees Ahmed, who's a best-selling author, international security scholar, and investigative journalist. He's the editor-in-chief of Insurge Intelligence at Medium.com and writes for Vice's science and technology magazine Motherboard, and is a weekly columnist for Middle East Eye. And his latest book is Failing States, Collapsing Systems. And, of course, at this point, Daesh, the Islamic State, ISIS, ISIL, I mean, one of the peculiar things that I find about this is that, Nafees, that we can't even agree on what how to call the enemy, as Donald Trump's made no secret of the fact that he thinks he's going to destroy Daesh, and which seems to be underway, although most of it seems to have been happening under Obama. Does this have to be put in that context, that because they're losing Mosul and under assault in Raqqa, their capital, does it therefore mean that the remnants will step up their attacks in these soft targets in Europe?
Well, I think there's a number of issues. I mean, the first thing, obviously, is that we know that London has been a target for ISIS for a while. We don't know whether this attack was an ISIS attack for sure. It seems to be likely that it was at least ISIS-inspired, but you know, we may find out differently. But if that is correct, then what we're seeing here really is quite a lower scale to the sort of sophisticated, multiple simultaneous coordinated attack that occurred in Paris, where we saw, you know, heavy weapons and kind of military tactics being deployed by a number of operatives who clearly had been planning their operation for some time. This was a very different type of attack. It was very rudimentary, very unsophisticated. It did not require the kind of planning that other attacks have required. So it's much lower down the scale. So that does suggest certainly that ISIS or whichever group is responsible for the attack, or even if it was a lone wolf, that it's not on the scale of what we've seen before. And so it's, in a sense, we are definitely seeing a kind of a weakening. And that would be consistent, I think, with the reality that ISIS is under pressure in Iraq and in Mosul. There has definitely been they have had to retreat. They've had to kind of fall back. They are worried, and we've seen in the past that ISIS have a tendency to, when they feel under pressure, then they try to remobilize and they do this sort of thing, and launching these kind of easier attacks is a way for them to try to maintain their momentum and attract attention to themselves and try to reposition themselves in the eyes of their target audiences. So that's definitely a possibility. On the other hand, the other risk, of course, of the operations in Mosul, and I did a piece on this recently in Middle East Eye, where I interviewed a couple of sources. One of them was Ross Caputi, who was a former U.S. Marine who had actually served in Iraq, and he, you know, fought in the first siege of Fallujah, or one of the sieges of Fallujah, experienced it with his own eyes, and he brought some very insightful commentary. And he said that, you know, the reality is that there's kind of an underreporting of the civilian casualties in Mosul. There's the additional problem that the atrocities of the Shia militia, backed by the Iraqi government, which obviously in this particular case are being backed by the United States. So there is this danger that even if we win in the short term the counterinsurgency operation in Mosul, we are laying the ground for a longer run insurgency. And even if ISIS itself is defeated, it's very possible that a successor group organization may arise. And this is actually something that we saw really with Iraq already, with the so-called success of the surge in, you know, the 2005-06-07 period, when we had the awakening and mobilizing Sunni tribes against al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, you know, years down the line, al-Qaeda in Iraq metamorphosed into ISIS. So that wasn't really a success. So I think this is something worth bearing in mind.
And in terms of the difference between an ISIS-directed and an ISIS-inspired attack, I take it that the attack on the Berlin market at Christmas and the truck mowing down people in Nice prior to that in France, they were ISIS-inspired as opposed to ISIS-directed. And this seems to be in that category, right, if that's a useful category.
Well, again, as you know, we don't have any firm evidence yet that ISIS was linked to this particular attack. Again, it's I think at the moment it's the top ranking hypothesis. Mm. It's certainly my top ranking hypothesis right now. But we might be proven wrong. It might be something different. However, having said that, I think what we do know is that ISIS often, even if they haven't inspired an attack, they often lay claim to having inspired an attack, organized an attack. So I would not be surprised in coming days that we hear ISIS make some sort of claim of responsibility. But it's important to to kind of keep an open mind at this stage, because things may change, facts may emerge, and we may find out that this is actually something else. But I think at the moment that does look like what we're seeing.
But what's different about this, and I guess this is information that still hasn't been completely pinned down. Apparently, there was a chilling post on 4chan a day before this attack that predicted this attack, and that was posted, appeared on the afternoon of March 21st, exactly 24 hours before the attack, and it featured a note written on paint that included that date, making clear that it had been posted to 4chan's politically incorrect board. And it had a picture of Big Ben, of course, which is where the parliament buildings are. So what do we know about that post? That's pretty unusual, isn't it?
That is unusual, if it's true. I've not heard that. This is the first time that I've heard that.
Right.
If it is true, then obviously it suggests that whoever posted that had some sort of connection to the attack itself. They would have had to have some kind of advance warning. So, I mean, this does raise all sorts of questions about who is basically running, you know, who these people are, what they're doing on 4chan, and what their links are to the group behind this. So this certainly complicates issues. It raises all sorts of questions. It may complicate the issue of whether we think this is an ISIS attack or an ISIS-inspired attack. As I said, it might not be. It might turn out to be, you know, the other candidates are the far right. You know, we've seen cases, you know, that we saw in Canada. You know, we had an attack that was initially thought to be an Islamist extremist attack, and actually turned out to be a far right attack. So it's quite possible that things change. At the moment, we don't know. But I mean, if this particular thread is followed up, it may open up some interesting angles.
Well, yeah, it's a bit cryptic. Apparently, the post was in Morse code, and it pointed to a URL, and that page provided the exact coordinates for the attack, which were the Westminster Bridge and the Parliament. So that's what's made people think that maybe, you know, it's pretty unusual for a terrorist to signal 24 hours ahead what they're about to do in a cryptic, even if it's done in a cryptic way. So I guess we'll have to figure out further.
If that is the case, I mean, that would be extremely unusual, and it would not fit the modus operandi that we've seen with ISIS in the past, right, or with other sorts of extremist groups that operate in this way. You know, Islamist extremist groups, we've not seen something like that. So I think the 4chan thing, if it's correct, if this report is correct, it opens up a can of worms, really, about what exactly has happened today and how we should make sense of it. And all I can imagine is that hopefully some more information will come to light about who actually posted that and what their what their wider network is.
But just in closing, the takeaway point to make here, and this certainly applies here in the United States, where if there were a terrorist attack, it would probably actually benefit Donald Trump's incredibly shaky presidency, which is the wheels are coming off as we speak. And that, of course, is a sad irony. The whole purpose of Daesh, Islamic State, ISIS, is to drive a wedge between Muslims living in the diaspora in the UK and France and other European countries and in the United States and the rest of the populations in these countries. That's their strategy, right?
Absolutely. That is what their strategy is. And I think generally what is very clear is that this is the strategy of extremists generally. Extremists want to divide. They want to see communities against each other, whether it's the far right or it's Islamist extremists, or it's ISIS specifically. You know, they want to basically divide communities, and they want to say that we cannot coexist, and they want to use this to justify their particular extremist visions. And in that sense, I think it's extremely important that people kind of really rally together and recognize these sorts of attacks as for what they are, which is they are attacks on all of us, and they are attacks on our ability and our willingness and our love of each other as human beings. and they are efforts to get us to turn on each other. So it's extremely important that we see that, whatever the agenda is, whoever's behind it ultimately, whichever group is doing it, it's important for us to see that and to say, no, we're not going to basically allow that approach to win or have any sort of victory. We are basically going to stand together and continue trying to build solidarity between and across communities. And I think when we do that, it makes it very difficult for people like Donald Trump or even more extreme groups to kind of exploit the situation, which is what they will try and do.
Well, Nafees Ahmed, I thank you very much for joining us from London.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nafees Ahmed, who's a best-selling author, international security scholar, and investigative journalist. He's the editor-in-chief of Insurge Intelligence at Medium.com and writes for Vice's science and technology magazine, Motherboard, and is a weekly columnist for Middle East Eye. And his latest book is Failing States, Collapsing Systems. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the growing evidence that treason was committed by Trump's top campaign official and his former national security advisor.
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of this Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's most foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Hi, Ian.
So, Bob, what's going on here with this Trump links and collusion with the Russians, which, of course, FBI Director Comey and head of the NSA, Admiral Rogers, testified about the other day? I mean, to reduce it down to the simplest terms, what Comey said was that the president is a liar and he is under FBI investigation. But now there seems to be a real smoking gun, and that is the AP is reporting that Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, once offered to help Vladimir Putin advance Russia's interests as part of a multi-million dollar contract, which he signed with a Russian billionaire who is close to Putin. So what do you make of that in the context of this constant drip, drip, drip of information about alleged ties to the Kremlin between the Trump campaign and Trump himself?
Well, Ian, there's a lot of smoking guns. I mean, frankly, you know, Flynn, he's on the Russian government payroll, Russian intelligence payroll, which is a former general. He's prohibited from taking foreign government money, emoluments clause. And then he passes classified information to the Russian ambassador. That sounds like a quid pro quo to me. I mean, it's way beyond collusion. Collusion would be suggest, hey, let's all sit down and, you know, exchange some ideas. Let's find some common ground. I mean, in the old days, this used to be called treason. You didn't take money from an adversary and then do their bidding and give them information. It was flat-out treason, but that word is meaningless, clearly, today. And then you have Roger Stone, the Trump advisor, the dirty trickster, in touch with the people who committed a crime in hacking Hillary emails, her emails, and Podesta's as well. I mean, that's gone unexplained. And now you have Manafort taking at least $10 million from a company that's connected with Russian intelligence, that does the bidding of the FSB, that does the bidding of Putin. So he is a proxy for Russian intelligence. I don't care if it happened 10 years ago. $10 million is still a lot of money. He went on their payroll. And when he was in the Ukraine, he was supporting, taking the money of a pro-Russian president who also was on the KGB payroll. So,
well, but by the way, Bob, the $10 million that he got from this Russian aluminum magnate, Oleg Deripaska, that was $10 million a year. That wasn't $10 million for the whole contract.
It's a lot of money, but the Russians got their, got their money for it. They got the whole thing about supplying the Ukraine with lethal weapons. It's buying influence in Washington. And I was just on TV now saying, well, Bill Clinton did a speech for the Russians. You know, if she's culpable, that doesn't make Trump innocent or the people around him. And end of story.
So then at what point does this sort of metastasize into something real? I mean, it's unfortunate that when the first information came out about Russian collusion from the intelligence community, President Obama felt restrained to making an issue out of it because the election was going on. And then in early January, when President Obama was still in the White House, the intelligence community came out with its final report saying that, in effect, the Russians interfered in the elections. They did so at the direction of Putin, and they did it in order to advance the candidacy of Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. At that point, it would seem to me that the president of the United States should have made a big deal out of it. I mean, this is the problem.
Oh, I think he should have.
Yeah.
There's the guarantee clause in the Constitution. He could have evoked that, which says if the United States is under foreign attack, which it was, and McCain said this, a lot of people, the FBI director said it, in his testimony as well as the NSA director. We were under attack, and technically the president could have postponed the vote until this was cleared up. That, of course, would have caused a constitutional crisis that I'm not sure we would have survived. It would have ended in some violence. So he had a hard decision, and what he did do was make sure that the evidence was spread across 17 intelligence agencies. I don't know if he demasked Flynn in that intercept with the Russians. That's yet to be determined. So he did the best he could, is just to get that information out, made his press statements and the rest of it. And we're seeing the result of that today. I certainly wouldn't second guess him on that. I don't understand the mood of this country. I don't understand the mood of this country when people say, oh, so what? Let's get over it. The Russians interfered in our election. Probably didn't make a difference. Do we really care that our sovereignty was under attack and deeply injured? I mean, I talk to people, and no, you don't get over that. That's like being, a part of your country invaded. The Russians did undermine American democracy. That is not up for debate. This isn't a conspiracy theory. Comey came out and said, look, they left their fingerprints everywhere. Comey didn't say that unless he was absolutely certain of it. And what has leaked out about it is, with the code and the metadata and the rest, was clearly Russian intelligence. And no, we can't get over it. And anybody who wears an American flag in their lapel and said, let's get over this Russian attack and get on with the Trump agenda, as far as I'm concerned, is treasonous.
Well, it's a very peculiar political environment where you've got the normally right-wing Republicans who were the Cold Warriors and hawks during the Cold War. They're making excuses for Putin, and people on the left who normally were suspicious of the CIA and of the military-industrial complex and of national security and in general, or American foreign policy, I should say, and in general, they are basically saying that any criticism of Putin is, trying to revive a Cold War, and it's a form of McCarthyism. So you've got the left expecting the CIA, that they normally hated, to somehow come up with the evidence to impeach this guy, and you've got the right in bed with Putin. It makes no sense anymore. But again, I thought that you know, at least in January, they could have had a commission of some kind, because your point is well taken. And I don't know why it's missed on so much of the American people and the media. And in general, it's not being put in the context that the United States was attacked. It was a kind of form of electronic form of Pearl Harbor. You know, it wasn't a military invasion, but it was an electronic invasion. And it had very, very damaging results. We can see that for ourselves. This is the most reckless, frightening presidency, because it's a combination of extreme arrogance and rank amateurism. And God knows, as Trump becomes more and more besieged in the White House, and he's already mentally unstable to begin with, he could lash out, change the subject, invade Iran, for God's sake.
Well, if we find out that Roger Stone, in fact, colluded in the hacking, committed a crime, and is about ready to go to jail, I mean, I don't know what the next stage of this is. I think it's perfectly plausible. I mean, it's clear that he gets his intelligence from Breitbart or Fox pundits over his own intelligence agency. So if Breitbart comes out and says, look, the Iranians are the guys behind the Islamic State, and they're killing Americans, and which, of course, is not true. And he reads that in Breitbart or hears a Fox commentator say that, you know, what's he going to call it, a nuclear strike? I mean, I don't know. That sounds, you know, dire on my part, and it probably is, but we don't know. But this whole attack on GCHQ, that he had tapped his phone lines and that Obama personally ordered it, is not grounded in any sort of reality. That didn't happen. And anybody who's done taps in this country and abroad knows it didn't happen. The police know it. It just didn't happen. It's completely contrary to fact. So we simply don't know when he's going to base a decision on fact or his fantasies, right-wing fantasies or any fantasies.
So just going back to General Flynn, apparently there's a lot more about Flynn that's going to come out, a relationship with a female Russian agent, etc. But my understanding is that the real purpose of his communications with the Russian ambassador was to tip off the Russians that Treasury was about to seize the assets of various of the oligarchs close to Putin, the people they call the Siloviki.
If you'd known that in advance, you'd have made a killing on the markets.
Right, but it enabled them to move their money before it was frozen by Treasury.
Presumably, or Putin's money. A lot of that is his.
Right.
Did the ambassador then call up the Kremlin and say, hey, got to move your money fast out of these companies because they're under... That's what he basically did, and he was in the transition at that time with the top secret security clearance, is pass on very sensitive information, which in my day used to be called espionage.
So back to Manafort then, and I mean, first of all, you get the impression that Trump himself is in trouble with, I mean, we were talking a minute ago about how shameful it is that conservatives who normally were suspicious of the Soviet Union and Russia are now making excuses for Putin and Trump. But my sense is that as this healthcare bill looks more and more in danger, if the House votes that down, everything that Trump has done so far has been a complete failure. The courts reversed many of his signature executive signings. And if the first bill that he tries to, with his name on it or with his name behind it, goes down, I don't see this guy lasting long. And it would seem like the emperor has no clothes, and even the Republicans aren't afraid of him anymore. So again, you get back to the idea of this completely unhinged, unqualified person roaming around the White House at night like King Lear, is likely to do something crazy. So do you think that General McMaster and people like that and Mattis can restrain him from doing something crazy?
Well, I agree with you, but we're not dealing with standards that you and I have sort of accepted, that the President of the United States says credible things based on credible information. And he may look at a defeat on health care as an opportunity to get back out in the press, get his ratings up. And I don't think the Republicans know what he's going to do. Is he going to turn on Congress, on the Republicans? Is he going to turn on Ryan? Is he going to attack? You know, you and I jumped, well, maybe he'll start something with Iran to get people's mind off, you know, Russia and the rest of it. Well, he might or he might not. I mean, the guy, I mean, I hate to say this, but, you know, you listen to some of his you know, some things he says, you know, in the campaign, and you go, wait, that makes sense. Yeah, we should do something about that. And then the next moment, it's 180 degrees, and he just says something off the wall. And to ask, you know, Mattis is not the most stable person. You know, I talk to military people a lot. Is he going to prevent Trump? I simply don't know. Those are counsels that I'm not led into. But I just think everything here on out is completely unpredictable, whether it's health care, foreign policy, or taking foreign policy from Breitbart.
Well, but in terms of the ability of someone like a McMaster, who everybody thinks is a pretty sober person, my understanding is the scary part is that McMaster himself doesn't have direct access to the Oval Office. He has to go through Stephen Bannon. So what's your understanding, though, of whether Trump could be restrained? Remember when Nixon got drunk, when Watergate was consuming him, Al Haig had to sort of tell everybody, you know, if he calls for a nuclear strike on Russia, ignore it, you know.
So, that's what I'm counting on, Ian. But if, you know, you have to look at it as if you were and I in the middle of the night drunk dialing, and we had to pay for it the next day. Eventually, especially if we were president of the United States, we'd simply give our phone away to a trusted aide to resist that temptation. He has it, and he's placed between him and the rest of the world, Ivanka, Jared Kushner, Steve Bannon, and this guy Gorka, who at Christmas time was waving a gun around National Airport and was arrested, and is probably a Hungarian fascist. So you don't know who's in control or who he's listening to. And I'm, you know, I'm reading newspapers like you are, and I'm also hearing at the other end that Kushner is going around saying, I'm in charge of the Middle East, and if you want a problem solved, come to me. And we know that Tillerson, Secretary of State, has been completely marginalized. I mean, he's come out and said, I didn't want the job. Right. I mean, I've never heard a Secretary of State say that.
Right.
So where is the adult supervision? Does it vary from moment to moment? You would need a GoPro camera in the Oval Office to figure that out.
Well, my understanding is that Ivanka's been put in the White House to calm him down, because she's the only one that can talk sense to him, to Trump, when he goes nuts, which he often does. She's the only one who can actually call him out. Everybody else is cowed by him. But just in the last couple of minutes then, Mattis it seems to be inclined to want to have a dust-up with the Iranians. It wouldn't take much to close off the Straits of Hormuz, which is the Iranian IRGC's tactic, I think, to sink some tankers. And if you attack them, they're going to immediately attack the Saudi oil facilities. The whole scenario seems crazy. I understand that the U.S. military likes those kind of wars against, you know, conventional forces like they did in Desert Storm. But surely there got to be some sober people inside the military and the intelligence world that thinks having a war with Iran, particularly if it's to distract the American people from the misrule of Trump, is a bad idea. But my understanding is they're pre-positioning material for just such a war.
I've heard they are pre-positioning material, whether it's a deterrent or they're actually going to use it. And the other thing, in all fairness, you can count on the Iranians, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, to do a provocation against one of our ships, you know, buzz it or whatever, and then Matt is saying that's enough. And he doesn't even need to go to the president. Just, you know, take out the airfields, their rockets, and the rest of it.
Yeah, but that's just the beginning. I mean, if you pick a war, that's kicking a hornet's nest, isn't it? I mean, look what happened to Jimmy Carter.
You know, we're going to be talking about gasoline in this country at, you know, $12 a gallon. That's what we're going to be talking about if the Gulf goes up in flames. But what really disturbs me is accusing GCHQ of tapping his phones. Right. That nothing in that statement is grounded in reality. Nothing. It just didn't happen. Or that Obama ordering it. He doesn't understand how the government works. He's susceptible to conspiracy theories. He's clearly paranoid. And he's unpredictable. And that's what should scare us. Is he going to launch a nuclear strike? Is he going to turn out to be the best president the United States has ever had? He's going to come to his senses? I don't have the answer to that.
Well, the last statement seems like a vain wish in the context of everything we've said. I don't know.
Keep hope alive.
Well, just in closing, though, I guess your point is well taken that if he doesn't believe GCHQ, and I've mentioned this before, just as a scenario, if, for example, GCHQ gets the intelligence, which they often do, they're very much an early warning frontline operation. Say they get the intelligence that the little green men are about to invade Estonia, and that's flashed to McMaster, the national security advisor, then he has to get past Bannon to get into the Oval Office to tell Trump. And will Trump believe GCHQ and call up his friend Putin and advise him not to proceed? Or will Trump believe Alex Jones or Breitbart?
He'll turn on Bill O'Reilly. That's what he'll do.
Well, oh, God, it's not funny. I thank you for joining us, Robert Baer.
Thank you. Bye, Ian.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who's one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing the likelihood of the passage of the Ryan and Trump health care bill. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Abby Gluck, who's a professor of law and the faculty director of the Solomon Center for Health Law and Policy at Yale Law School, where she focuses on Congress and the political process, federalism, civil procedure, and health law. She has extensive experience working as a lawyer in all levels of government and clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Welcome to Background Briefing, Abby Gluck.
Thank you for having me.
And today was the third and final day of testimony by Judge Neil Gorsuch to take the seat of the vacated seat of Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court. And frankly, it's extraordinary how it's become sort of meaningless kabuki theater. No important questions and no important questions can be asked, but no answers come forth, to the point where Dianne Feinstein today was so frustrated that she said to Gorsuch, quote, "What worries me is you have been very much able to avoid any specificity like no one I have ever seen before." So what are the point of these hearings if you don't learn anything about it? You may learn what's in the head of the candidate in terms of, you know, complexities about the majesty of law, but you'd never find out what's in their heart.
You know, we've come to a point where we can't put people on Supreme Court who have even any kind of paper track record. So you're going to get sort of fewer law professors. You're never going to get a U.S. senator on the Supreme Court, when many people think we should have an elected official on the Supreme Court. We're at this point where the blander it is, the more likely you're going to get through, because Congress will seize on anything they can to try to stop a nominee. And the result is you get these performance art hearings that don't do more than show judicial temperament. And, you know, Gorsuch has showed that he has the sort of judicious, calm, collected temperament, but he hasn't really told us very much about the kind of judge he'll be.
And turning to the healthcare bill that seems to be stalled in the House, and we know that it'll have an even more uphill climb in the Senate. On Tuesday, Donald Trump went to the House and apparently threatened the wayward Tea Party Freedom Caucus, as they call themselves. And it doesn't look like that's worked. They seem more defiant than ever. So what's your assessment of the likelihood of the passage of, I guess we could call it the Ryan and Trump healthcare bill?
It's not looking so good for them right now. I do think that the House is under enormous, the Republican Party, frankly, is under enormous pressure to pass something. I think one possibility is that we're going to get something much more minor than anybody expected to get. I think the other possibility is that they'll try to make more concessions and just get something through the House and then leave it to the Senate to clean up. They've said several times, I heard Ryan say several times already, that we're just the beginning of this process. Let's get something through and leave it to the Senate to make it better. And so I think the question is, how likely that's going to be. But the Republicans are also finding out that, you know, healthcare policy isn't easy. And they rushed this thing through as opposed to giving it sort of the time and deliberation that it deserved to come up with a good fix.
But do you think, though, if it fails to pass in the House, could that be seen as the beginning of the end of the Trump administration, since, in effect, the emperor will be exposed as not having any clothes in terms of his threats to the wayward Tea Party, and wouldn't it impugn his clout over his own party in his first effort to get a bill passed?
Well, the health care reform appeal has been very important to the momentum of the administration. So they wanted to come in, they wanted to repeal and replace it the first day. This has definitely dragged them down and made it them see that it's hard to govern. So I think that every day that this further delays them is going to hurt their overall agenda. We all know the first 50, 100, even 200 days of administration are the most important when a president has his most credit, his most credibility. And wasting all of this on a failed Affordable Care Act repeal will be very detrimental to the administration. The other thing I would just add to this, though, is that Trump has been saying something now very different than he said on the campaign trail. The bill that they put out is nothing like the bill that he said he would put out on the campaign trail. So in terms of his credibility on policy promises, he's already passed the line of keeping his promises.
But he's also already had problems with his executive orders on the Muslim ban.
Well, that, again, just like the health care bill, that's a problem of rushing. Right, he put those orders out without consulting the proper lawyers, without going through the normal bureaucratic process of vetting an executive order, and he saw what that did. Similarly, with the health care bill, maybe had they had held more hearings, perhaps had they waited for the Congressional Budget Office score, instead of just trying to push it through, they could have come up with a plan that was more amenable to more people, and that, frankly, was less cruel to large sectors of the American public, people who vote for Republicans.
And again, I'm speaking with Abby Gluck, who's a professor of law and the faculty director of the Solomon Center for Health Law and Policy at Yale's Law School, where she focuses on Congress and the political process, federalism, civil procedure, and health law. She has extensive experience working as a lawyer in all levels of government and clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But is the dynamic at play here, Abby, that in order to placate the Tea Party insurrection, that Paul Ryan has to make compromises, and they, of course, feel that this doesn't go far enough, that it should be even more crueler, in fact. And so the more that they make compromises in that direction, surely the more likely that this is going to be less user-friendly and eventually create even more of a backlash, because we've seen these town hall meetings where constituents have been really setting the pants on fire of their Republican representatives.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that to please the caucus, they're going to have to cut back on a bunch of the bill's benefits. I think it's also not at all insignificant that the more they do that, the less popular the bill will be in the Senate. Remember that the Senate was already putting up a lot of yellow flags when they saw the first draft of the bill, simply because of its draconian cuts to Medicaid and the numbers from CBO showing that 24 million people were going to lose their health insurance over the next 10 years. If they go further, we're going to have an even more terrifying CBO report, and the chances that those cuts will get through the Senate are fairly limited.
But you mentioned a minute ago that you thought that this would be a watered-down weak bill that the Senate could work on. How does that gel with what you just said?
Yeah, let me clarify that. What I meant by that is that I think that they're under enormous pressure to pass something or will look like a huge failure for the Trump administration and the Republican Party. I don't think it will be this. I feel that if they pass something at this point, given the divisions, if they insist on moving through as quickly as they are, they're not going to be able to get anything that has much teeth. They'll be able to put something together that is a tweak or a fix or give states more options under the current Affordable Care Act framework. They will label it the Affordable Care Act repeal. They will give it a different name, but it may not be that different in effect with the way things are going now, because it doesn't look like they're going to be able to do the dramatic upheaval they said they wanted to do.
So, in other words, when Donald Trump recently said that healthcare is more complicated than he thought, I mean,
who knew? It was so complicated.
Right. But is this a kind of paradoxical victory for Barack Obama after all of the demonization? We're talking about years of demonization, and that seems to be really where I'm trying to figure out where things are between the demonization that's gone on in the red states and amongst Trump's supporters on the one hand, and then the footage we've seen of these town hall meetings where constituents are basically saying to their Republican representatives, get your hands off, not Obamacare. That's different from the Affordable Care Act.
That's right. I'm not a political scientist, but there are a bunch of statistics floating around with polls that show that Americans are against Obamacare, where they don't want to change their health care. They like the health care they got under the Obama administration. So, in terms of the demonization of Barack Obama, I think that the Obama administration failed in a huge way in marketing this bill, right? They passed this major statute. They didn't teach the American public about it. They didn't get credit for it. No one is going to give him credit in the Republican Party for what he accomplished. So if they wind up tweaking the bill and stabilizing the insurance markets, they will bill it as a Republican victory because they're never going to cede that ground to President Obama, even though he really was responsible for shifting the needle on the baseline premise that every single person in this country should have some minimal level of health care. That is really what the Affordable Care Act did that no other statute did before. And the fact that that's the baseline, that's what people are fighting over, that's what the Senate is worried to disturb, really shows the success of the statute and the difficulty the Republicans are going to have to unwind it.
And again, I'm speaking with Abby Gluck, who's a professor of law and the faculty director of the Solomon Center for Health Law and Policy at Yale Law School, where she focuses on Congress and the political process, federalism, civil procedure, and health law. She has extensive experience working as a lawyer in all levels of government and clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But is that to say that Paul Ryan, we're talking about the Tea Party making compromises, which is certainly doesn't appear to be in their nature, but could Paul Ryan then compromise? Because he seems to be quite ideological in his determination to cut Medicaid or even help get rid of it in the long run, because he made it clear in an interview with Hugh Hewitt that he was crowing about the possibility that finally we're going to stop a government program. They call them entitlement programs, which of course is a terrible misnomer because people are essentially entitled to what they've paid for. But nevertheless, the idea that cutting Medicaid is something to be proud of, which appears to be the position that Ryan has taken, could he compromise? In other words, what I take from what you just said is that if they just do this tweaking and relabel it and declare victory, they'll actually be doing themselves a favor because the American people are not going to be furious that their health care has been tampered with.
Yeah, I think that's the political motivation for just tweaking with it and relabeling it. What you said about Paul Ryan is absolutely correct. He does not share Donald Trump's or Barack Obama's philosophy of American health care. Trump and Obama both have said publicly, Trump said it many times, that we're not going to take health care away from everybody. Everybody should have health care. Paul Ryan does not take that view. He's never taken that view. His plan has never been that way. He takes a view much more closely associated with the idea that you get the health care you can earn, right? And that we want to reduce the scale of government. The idea that the states are going to turn around and provide this health care for their poorest citizens is just fantasies. They still don't have the money or the ability to do that without the federal government's help. So Ryan, as you say, is in a very difficult position because he has to decide between the political expediency of making sure the members of the Republican Party get reelected and don't get forced out of office out of furor over health care, showing he can pass something, which may be more important in the end than passing something that he wants, but then his long-standing position that is antithetical to the framework of the Affordable Care Act, and that would require taking health care away from millions of people to further that position.
Well, of course, it's no small irony that Paul Ryan's heroine, Ayn Rand, ended up on Medicare and Social Security, right?
Well, I think the one thing people don't understand, there's a professor at the University of Kentucky, Nicole Huberfeld, who's written about this extensively, this idea that most of us are going to be on Medicaid someday. So since Medicaid covers nursing long-term care at the end of life, a lot of very well-off people wind up being on Medicaid in their old age. And the stigma of Medicaid as a program for the poor has never been fully erased. But there are some academics who feel that if people really understood the reach of Medicaid to all the different populations that it does, it might change the conversation in healthcare. Because let me just say, I said this in other contexts, but not yet on this show, the federal government subsidizes a lot of healthcare, not just for poor people. Those of us who get their insurance from their employer are benefiting from a huge federal tax break that the government gives for those kinds of employer-subsidized health plans. We don't think about it that way. People are very quick to look down on entitlement programs for the poor, but these tax benefits are entitlement programs for the rich as well.
Well, of course, one aspect of the Ryan bill, though, is to remove the obligation on the part of big corporations to provide health care to their employees.
Yes, but not remove the tax benefit that incentivizes them to do it. So right now, we all get health care as part of, those of us who get health care from our employers get a subsidized payment. If all of a sudden we were paying $24,000 each year for health care that we got through our employment, we would all be much more upset. Early drafts of the House bill had flirted with the idea of diminishing that tax benefit for employer-sponsored health plans, and met with so much resistance they didn't touch it in the end.
Well, Abby Gluck, I thank you very much for joining us and appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, Abby, speaking with Abby Gluck, who's a professor of law and the faculty director of the Solomon Center for Health Law and Policy at Yale Law School, where she focuses on Congress and the political process, federalism, civil procedure, and health law. She has extensive experience working as a lawyer in all levels of government and clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes Podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.